everybody. Welcome back. Thank you for tuning in once again. I hope you're doing well. We are delighted to be able to speak to you again wherever you're tuning in from. As you might know, my name is Henrik and we're based out of Sweden on the Scandinavian peninsula. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com is our websites. You can follow us on a regular basis for much more radio, videos, and news on many other topics that we find to be, well, fascinating and also worth to be educated about. Today we're going to hear from Judy Byington. She is the author of the book 22 Faces, and we're going to listen to the story of Jenny Hill, an alleged satanic ritual abuse survivor with 22 different personalities that was developed under traumatic and ritual abuse conditions, with a compelling drive to educate the public on the unimaginable horrors faced by children born into families practicing ritual abuse. Judy Byington continues to pen books about survivors like Jenny Hill, who suffer repressed childhood memories of forced participation in rape, torture, and murder. Well, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Judy. It's good to have you with us. Thank you for taking the time talking with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate being on your program.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting. We have a lot to discuss, of course. It's a big subject, and we've brushed upon it in different contexts in the past. But tell us briefly about your background, Judy, and how you got involved in the case that we're going to discuss today with Jenny Hill.
I'm a retired therapist, and I had to retire early because of an illness of a daughter. But when I was a therapist, I had people, some of my clients approach me and they would say things like, I can't remember my childhood and I'm having nightmares of abuse situations, really weird abuse situations that appeared to happen to me, but I can't remember them. And I hear voices in my head, you know, things like that. And I really didn't quite understand what was happening then. I didn't understand that they could have been dissociative, which is another name for a dissociative identity disorder, which is multiple personalities. And but after I retired, there were two women that approached me. They were cousins. They were mothers. They were both 24 years old. And they were beginning to have these memories of abuse situations in childhood where they had been, they were identifying the same types of murders, being raped by their fathers, same types of tortures by their fathers. And they were really confused about it. And one of the reasons they were having these memories is because one of the fathers was the first arrest of a newly hired Utah satanic ritual abuse investigators. And there's quite a history about, you know, why they were, why we had ritual abuse investigators, but I could go in later. But anyway, they asked for me to help them because they were only charging this father with a couple of counts of sexual abuse on one of the daughters, and yet they had been raped continually throughout childhood by him and by his brother, and had were starting to remember seeing murders, child murders from them. So they wanted me to help them gather information and take it to the Utah AG office for the court case. So I worked with them for quite a few months. And we eventually, we went out to different sites where they alleged to, you know, see these murders, and they started to have more memories. And what was interesting about the memories is that they corresponded with each other. They would have, we'd go out to sites and then they'd go home and then they'd remember more about what went on, and then we get together and their details were almost exactly the same of what they felt happened. So I was taking this information up to the Utah AG office, and the AG office at that point decided not to go any further with that particular information. They were concerned that these women were multiple personalities and wouldn't be good witnesses in court and whatever. So then I took the information to an FBI agent. The very same day I went to this agent, Jenny Hill approached him. Now, Jenny Hill, she was here in Utah, but she had been abused in California, Garden Grove, California. And she had seen at age 6 a little girl murdered. And she was trying to find the parents of the girl. And so she had approached this very same agent the very same day that I did. And the FBI agent eventually decided not to open a case for either one of us, but he did put us together. And eventually, Jenny asked that I write her biography. So that's what I wrote, 22 Faces, Inside the Extraordinary Life of Jenny Hill and Her 22 Multiple Personalities.
Very good. There's a lot to the story. Of course, we're going to get into some of the details of this here. But obviously, while reading, you know, about the subject overall, DID, dissociative identity disorder, and trying to, you know, approach it without too much bias, preconceived conclusions, it's obvious that it's a very charged topic. And a lot of people are, you know, fighting over the people more or less that have not made their mind up about it yet. So, you know, often, you know, cited from on the opposition to some of these suggestions is that the, you know, satanic ritual scare of the 1980s, you know, was all made up. There's nothing real substantial behind these allegations, etc. There's a lot of discussion going on here. But why do you think it is that it's such a charged and controversial topic? And there seems to be very difficult to coming to any kind of consensus about this topic, Judy. Why is that, do you think?
Well, as far as survivors of the ritual abuse are concerned, it isn't controversial. And my inclination is to think that there's a lot of perpetrators out there that are trying to cover it up. And the reason I say that is you mentioned the 1980s Satanism scare. That was a term that is actually coined by people who seem to believe in false memory. In the false memory, they call it a syndrome, but it's never accepted as a syndrome in the psychiatric manual. But what happened in the 1980s was there was a book that came out that's called Michelle Remembers, and it became a bestseller, and it was about a little girl up in Canada who had been given to a satanic coven by her mother, and when she grew up, she started having these memories of ritualized abuse, and her and Lawrence Pazder, who's a psychiatrist, wrote the book Michelle Remembers, and it became a bestseller in 1980. And after that book came out, there were literally thousands of ritual abuse survivors that started going to therapists saying, this happened to me. And around 1983, there was an organization formed called the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Disassociation, ISSTD. That is a very large therapy group that was formed because they needed treatment modules to treat ritual abuse survivors, who most of them had multiple personalities. And there's over 900 therapists in that group as of today. So you know that they're treating a large amount of ritual abuse survivors. And along with that was the reason for the hiring of these ritual abuse investigators at the Utah Attorney General's office, because LDS Social Services, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is centered here in Utah.
Yep.
And they have a counseling arm called the LDS Social Services, and they were also receiving a large amount of people coming to them and saying they'd been ritually abused. So they did a study, and it took them a year. And in that study, one of the sentences in it is that 45 members viewed human sacrifice. Now, the man that did that study was an elder in the church. His name was Glenn Pace, and the First Presidency gave me an exclusive interview with Elder Pace. And Elder Pace told me that they had interviewed over 100 people, and they could have interviewed three times that many if they'd had the time. But what they did with that report is that they hired a genealogist, and they trace the lines of the perpetrators, because a lot of the satanic ritual abuse comes down in multi-generational families. And they identified what perpetrators they could, they excommunicated them from the church, and then they turned that information over to the Utah Attorney General. At the very same time, the Utah Attorney General had done their own study. It was headed by Dr. Noemi Mathis, and they interviewed investigators and therapists in the state of Utah, and they came up with some of the same perpetrators. as was in the LDS report. And as a result of that, that's why they hired the Utah Attorney General Ritual Abuse Investigators. And the father of these two women that approached me was the first arrest of those investigators. A long answer to your question is, I don't think it was a Satanism scare. I think that was a term that was coined by perpetrators, because there are a large amount of ritual abuse and mind control survivors out there still seeking treatment and still trying to get some attention to this.
Well, indeed, and that's what makes it even more difficult, of course, to determine. I mean, this goes all the way up to Harvard. When was a 2012 news article came out on their online version, the Gazette, where they call it, that talked about how some of the research there is now casting doubts, basically, on dissociative identity disorder and everything else. So it's very difficult to determine as an outside what to believe and what to make of this. But what do you make of things like, as you said, then the False Memory Syndrome Foundation? There's all these other associations out there. There's there basically more or less to debunk the phenomena, right?
Right. Well, the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, first of all, there's no such thing as a false memory syndrome. In order to be a syndrome, you have to have valid studies behind you. And there's never been enough valid studies done on false memory to create, you know, a diagnosis for it in the psychiatric manual, the DSM. There is a diagnosis in the DSM called dissociative identity disorder. It was first put in there as DID in 1994, I believe, or 1992, or anywhere around that area. But it used to be called multiple personality disorder in there. So as far as the professional community is concerned, there is not a controversy. You know, there is dissociative identity disorder. There is not false memory syndrome.
I see. Now, okay, it's just, I'm playing advocate, devil's advocate here a little bit, obviously, because we want to try to, you know, get the other side of this a little bit as well. But well, we might return a little bit to that later. But let's just hear a little bit more about Jenny Hill's story then, and where, you know, when this begins, and you know, lay this out for people who don't know anything about the story.
Like I say, I met Jenny back in about 1992, and at that time she was searching for this little girl that she had saw killed. She alleges that when she was about 4 years old, she began undergoing sexual abuse by her father. And then by six, there were also two teenagers down the street who were sexually abusing her and torturing her. But they were also torturing her under the supervision of a man that we later found out was called Dr. Green, or Greenbaugh. And he was a mind control programmer expert from Nazi Germany. And there's a whole history on him with the CIA that I could go into later. But these boys and Dr. Green took her at age six to a satanic ceremony on June 21st, 1965, summer solstice. And there she was almost killed in a human sacrifice ceremony, but another little six-year-old was also killed, was killed in that ceremony. And that trauma caused her thinking patterns, along with the other trauma that she'd gone through since age four, to separate into multiple personalities. Now, to understand that, you have to kind of think of your mind as a tree, and the trunk of the tree is your core personality. And if you're a child, and if you're undergoing trauma, then if you go, a traumatic experience kind of branches out, makes a branch of that tree. And alter personalities will hold the memories in that branch for 20, 30, sometimes 40 years until the core personality is in a safe place and can process the traumatic memory. So as she grew up, her alters took over at times. Alters are formed to protect the core personality. And so if she would get into a situation where they felt like they needed to protect her, then they just take over. So she had periods of her life that were just absolutely blank. And that was when her different alters would take over. And that happened to her until she was about 24 years of age. And by that time, she had gone to school. And by the way, I found I've met a lot of people with multiplicity, and I find them to be extremely intelligent. Jenny was able to get a nursing degree, and she went into the Utah State Psychiatric Hospital to apply for a job. During the job interview, she changed personalities, and she ended up staying there at the hospital. And over that year's period of time that she stayed in the hospital, her alters felt safe enough to talk about their experiences. And so that's when we found out all of her multiple personalities. She has actually three alter families of personalities. But that's when she began to heal, is when she recognized that she was multiple.
Was she held at the hospital against her will, or was this condoned by her part?
No, she was asked if she would like to stay.
Okay.
And of course she didn't want to, but they kind of forced her into saying, they says, well, you know, we'll take it to a judge if you don't, because we really feel like you're not able to care for your children. She had two boys at the time. But she realized that she needed some help. And so it was her decision to stay. And it was a good decision, because it was once you're able to recognize that you have multiplicity, that, see, these alters always want to tell their story. They want to tell what happened to them. They want to tell about the abuse that formed the alter personality. And the ability to do that starts the healing process.
Now, if we just for a moment take a more a pop culture reference, is, I don't know if you saw the TV show United States of Tara, but is there anything like that that was portrayed in that series, do you think? If you saw it, that is.
Show type of thing. Multiple personalities are always formed from abuse, and they're always formed from child abuse. It has something to do with the developing brain of a child, which causes the multiplicity. Like, all of us dissociate. You know, dissociative identity disorder is the far end of the spectrum as far as disassociation is concerned. Like daydreaming, for instance, that's disassociation. And we all daydream or do whatever. Or we could be driving down the street and not remember, you know, the last 3 miles that we drove. That's disassociation. It's a disconnect from life events. Then about in the middle of the spectrum is post-traumatic stress disorder, which, of course, you see in veterans of war and people that have been through traumatic experiences as adults. They suffer post-traumatic stress. That's another form of disassociation, where multiple personality is the far end of the spectrum, where the thinking patterns actually separate. As you think, your mind builds little neurons, and they're connected by electrical circuits. And for some reason, the electrical circuit that connects that memory, that abuse memory of a child, to the core personality, the electrical circuit isn't there. And it doesn't appear until, you know, many years later.
So traumatic experiences causes the personality to split more or less. In this, when this occurs, I don't know if there's any brain research that has been done on this, but could it be said that even the neural patterns, the activity of the brain is compartmentalized to a certain degree, that it's being kept in certain areas, or is this more on a psychological level than physiological? What do you think?
Oh, no, there's been a lot of studies done. And if you go into the ISSTD website, there's a huge amount of research done in there, professional research on how this compartmentalization that occurs. And like I say, the multiple personality only happens to a child. So when you're talking about a person who is multiple, you're talking about someone who has been severely abused during childhood.
Right, right. And then later stages, and we can get into this in more detail, how many, you know, different personalities that can be in there, if there's a limit, etc. But what triggers the different personalities to come forward? Is it simply another trauma that awakens the memory of a previous trauma, or how does that work?
Well, to understand that, you need to, I'll just make Jenny as an example.
Right, right, yeah.
She had three specific types of trauma. She had the sexual abuse that was being done by her father, allegedly being done, excuse me, by her father and by these boys and Greenbaum. And then she has a whole family of alters that are headed by her head altar, JJ. And in the book, in the front part of the book, there's an altar chart that shows all this. But there's she has a head altar, JJ, that's over the sexual abuse memories. And then she has a head altar, Angelique, that's over the ritual abuse memories, this torture and seeing this child sacrifice and all that. There's a whole group of altars over that. And then there's a third altar family that just is composed of one altar, and that was formed because she, as a preteen, she was gang raped. Her altar personality, JJ, took over after she was coming out of middle school and got her in a situation where she was gang raped. So she has these three families of altars, and then as these altars form, they form for specific purposes, like the Angelique is the head altar of the ritual abuse memories, and she formed because of the torture. And then, of course, JJ formed because of the sexual abuse, but then JJ didn't, you know, they have specific personalities, and they have feelings, and they think of themselves as differently, you know, and their eyes are specific colors. But JJ liked the pleasurable parts of sex, and she didn't like the parts that hurt and the other traumas. So she actually divided off into other personalities to take over when she was having more traumatic sexual experiences rather than the pleasurable. And in this this Nazi mind controller that programmed Jenny, he has a very specific programming that he does. And from the survivors that I've talked to, there are some very specific altars that they form. Like they form a homicidal altar. And they name that a specific Latin name so that later on, if the perpetrator knows that this person has been programmed, then they can call forth that Latin name and it'll actually have the altar will come forth and take over the mind and body. I went on Dr. Phil, and before we went on the program, they asked us to do a video of Jenny changing personalities. And so I asked Jenny if she wanted to do that, and she said, yes, she would. So I sat down with her, and I said, would you please bring JJ forth? And there's a video of this on YouTube where you can see it. And so JJ actually came forth, and then she talks. And then we say, would like to, you know, talk to someone else. Is there someone else in there that would like to come forward? And then JJ comes back, and then she says, I'll let somebody else come forward. JJ's kind of in charge of the sexual abuse altars. And then she let this Janice come forward. Janessa is the homicidal altar that was formed in Jenny. She's very mad and angry. And so they have one that takes the torture. They have one that they form for the sexual abuse. They have one that they form to be homicidal. There always seems to be one that's suicidal. And then they have, most people have, well, I would say all multiple personalities have one altar that's kind of a peacemaking altar. And in Jenny, it's a Lady of Peace and Harmony. And she goes through and she kind of helps the other altars understand what's going on, and she settles arguments and does whatever. And then with this green programming, they also have an evil altar. In Jenny, that's called Alter the Evil One. But there are some very specific altars that come forth and are formed through torture and through whatever the child is going through.
Can she call these at any point, any one of them?
Jenny can ask her head altars to come forth. But the head altars are kind of in charge of the other altars. She can ask any altar to come forth, but whether or not the altar will, it's kind of up to the altar. I have a friend who is very well healed. She has 50 multiple personalities. And her personalities aren't as defined as Jenny's, but they're more like thinking pattern. they're just fragments of a personality. And, you know, they don't, some of them have names, some of them don't. But it's different in every multiple personality, because the abuse is different. You know, the child goes through different abuse situations, right, depending on what happens to them. So there's a lot of multiples that are alike, and everybody's different depending on their situation.
Right, right. But there are 22, obviously, as implied by the book title. But did you track all of these, or whoever did? How did they go about figuring these out and naming all of them, etc.?
Well, when she was at the Utah State Hospital, they had 17 of them defined at the state hospital. See, I didn't meet Jenny until many years later, and we spent close to 20 years writing her biography. And how we would write the biography is we decided on which sections of her life, you know, we were going to have in the book. Then I would have her write out that particular section of her life. And as she did, her alters would take over and they would write out their abuse experiences. And so through those writings, we counted up eventual 22 multiple personalities. We thought right before, when we were getting towards the end, we thought there were 21, and then we realized that the spiritual alter, Virginia, had actually divided out an unnamed alter. We just call her the unnamed alter because I don't know if she has a name. Some of the alters name themselves, some don't. But that was when we discovered that there were 22. Now, she may have even more because I know she's had some memories come back since we wrote the book. So there may be even more, but that we're just not aware of.
Interesting. Now, there's a lot of different characters here that shows up that I want to ask more about, and some of the events that happened to Jenny. But just to clarify some other things here as well, there's a diary, obviously, that Jenny kept and wrote in, where also a lot of information have been extracted from, correct?
Correct. Uh-huh. Well, it wasn't one diary, it was many.
Many, okay. And what was the nature of some of these entries, if there's a pattern here that you can just, you know, talk a little bit about? What was it in there usually?
Well, Jenny would write in her diary, and then sometimes her alters would take over, and oftentimes in her younger years, it was her alter JJ who's over the sexual abuse memories. Especially during her teenage years, JJ would take over, and she'd put in, and it's in the book, in the center part of 22 Faces are copies of her alter writings. And in the younger years, Jenny would, you know, write out an entry in her diary, and then after that, she'd sign it Jenny, and then there would be an entry next time by JJ. And then she'd write some more as Jenny, and then JJ would come in and write some more and kind of go like that.
I see. Now, let's see here if we can talk a little bit about some of the things that happened to her. And if you believe your assessment at this point is that all the events that were traumatic, if were all these planned, this was someone, you know, behind this and figured this out, because I think that Greenbaum showed up a little bit later, if you will, in her life, correct? And this was something then that began allegedly with her father, correct?
Well, like I say, allegedly it started with her father at age 4, but at age 6 was when Greenbaum came into the picture. And he mind controlled her for, what was it, three or four months, and then took her to this satanic ceremony where she saw the child sacrificed. And then after that ceremony, the police actually came to the house, and Greenbaum disappeared. So he was only in there for, you know, like a half a year or so of her life.
Where did this take place, this first one, when with this? Because she was meant to be a survivor, right? This was one of the tenets in the book. And explain that a little bit on what the intention was here.
The intention of Greenbaum?
Well, I guess first we can talk about the intention of her being a survivor of a human sacrifice.
Well, actually, she was supposed to be killed at this sacrifice ceremony she went to. And there was an intervention there that I'll let you read the book, you know, to find out what it was.
It was a little bit of a supernatural incursion, shall we say, correct?
Correct. And you'd have the book to understand it. But no, she was actually scheduled to be sacrificed.
Okay.
But how a survivor becomes a survivor is around their teenage or preteen years or teenage years. When they grow up in these satanic families, they make a decision of whether or not to be a survivor or whether to be part of the satanic, you know, rituals and stuff they've been involved with since childhood. And a lot of the survivors I've talked to have made that decision to become a survivor. Of course, as children, they don't remember what they're going through. Like, for instance, this one survivor I was talking to, she went to satanic ceremonies till she was 17 years old. And then one day she went to this one ceremony and she just decided, I didn't want to, you know, be a part of this anymore. So she walked away from the ceremony and she walked, I think it was 10 miles back to her home. Her father, who was, you know, the perpetrator, he never raped her or took her to any more ceremonies after that point in time. And the same happened to Jenny, is after this ceremony that she went to at age six. Well, the father did, you know, abuse her until she was a preteen, but she didn't go to any more satanic ceremonies after age six. And then when she was a preteen, when she started having her cycle, and the father realized that she might get pregnant, that's when he quit abusing her. So her abuse ended about her preteen years.
Let's see if we can talk a little bit more about Dr. Greenbaum, you know, who he is, where he come from. You know, he's been called Dr. Green, and I remember reading about other mind control, you know, trauma-based mind control programs running, and he seems to be a recurring character in some of these stories. He shows up, you know, again and again. So what is known about him, and where does he come from?
Well, Dr. Colin A. Ross writes the foreword to 22 Faces. And Dr. Ross is a psychiatrist who runs clinics for ritual abuse survivors in Michigan and Texas and California, and he has the Ross Institute. So he's a very well knowledgeable in this field. And he says in the foreword to 22 Faces that Greenbaum was brought into the U.S. In 1950 with the Project Paperclip CIA mind control program. So that's one thing we know about Greenbaum. Another thing we know about him is that there's Cordon Hammond. Cordon Hammond is a psychologist who was at the first meeting back in 1983 when they formed the International Society for Study of Trauma and Dissociation, ISSTD. And after that meeting, he got together with 18 other therapists, and they did an eight-year study of their clients. And Cordon Hammond gave a speech for this Washington, D.C. Psychiatric Institute, I believe it was in 1994 or 1992, I can't remember. But around that time, he gave, and you can find it on the internet, it's called the Greenbaum Speech. And in that speech, he gives some results of his study, and he says in there that 75% of the clients that they studied were programmed by this Dr. Green. Then we have the 2007 Extreme Abuse Survey, and this can also be found on the internet. It's called the 2007 Extreme Abuse Survey, and in that survey, 124 said that one of their perpetrators went by the name of Dr. Green. And then we have Christine Nicola. Now, Christine Nicola is a survivor who was asked to testify at the congressional hearings on CIA radiation experiments in 1995. And you can see her YouTube testimony and that of another survivor and another therapist that gave testimony at those hearings by going into our website, childabuserecovery.com, and we have the history of CIA mind control in there. And then you can go into the YouTube videos, but you can also Google it. Christine Nicola at the CIA Radiation 1995 congressional hearings. And in there, Christine talks about her programmer being Dr. Green. And she was actually, as a young child, kept in a cage in his office. And once in a while, she would get out of the cage and look through the she was with him off and on for like 7 years or so until she was 14. But once she got out of the cage and looked through some of the papers in his office, and one of the papers she found was a document that showed that he had received $50 million from the CIA to run the mind control program. And that was Dr. Green. Now, there are other survivors who also talk about Dr. Green, but they describe him differently than Jenny and some of the people in the Hammond study describe him. Jenny describes him as short with balding brown hair, walked with a limp in his left leg, carried a cane, and had a German accent. Some of the other survivors describe Dr. Green differently and kind of like Mengele.
Right.
So we know that there are more people than one who was referred to as Dr. Green, and then they also had a Dr. White and a couple other colors too. So there are obviously other Nazi mind controllers that were called Dr. Green other than him.
Could this have something to do with the fact that it's just called, as far as I know, then the Green, you know, mind control program, pretty much, that it could be just the technique per se, and then there's different doctors that have applied to that same technique?
Right. Uh-huh. Very, very possible.
Interesting. But what do you think about the, you know, Joseph Mengele connection? Is it possible the Greenbaum actually was Mengele transported out? I mean, he went down to South America. He was in Buenos Aires in 56, and that he was later, you know, brought up to the United States from South America. What do you think?
I think it's a possibility by the mere fact that I've heard a couple of mind control survivors describe him as they thought, you know, they've seen pictures of him and they say, hey, that's the man that, you know, was torturing me as a young child. So I think it's very possible, yes.
Now, what would you say constitutes satanic ritual abuse and what some of the components of that is, and if it's a very specific, I don't know, occult procedure that is done? Is it invoking Satan, or how? Where is the satanic portion of this? Where does that come into the picture?
Okay, well, the history of the CIA mind control program, of course, goes back to the Nazis, and Hitler was a very big fan of Satan worship. Luciferian worship is what they called it. But SRA, so we know that they used these children in regular, you know, experiments, but they also used them. They also used satanic covens, such as Jenny was mind controlled in. But SRA is called satanic ritual abuse, and it means the physical, sexual, or psychological abuse by a person who invokes the name of Satan. But in mind control, well, in 1999, the Dictionary of Psychology defined ritual abuse as controlling people with physical, sexual, psychological mistreatment through rituals. So it's just, I know from talking to many ritual abuse survivors, there's always children involved. There's always a big sex orgy before the ceremony where the children are sexually abused. There's also torture of children involved. And then they're made to witness the murder of other children. So we're always talking sex abuse, sexual abuse, torture, and murder of children when we're talking about ritual abuse.
And so all of this is a plan to formulate different personalities within the child. Is that correct? I mean, yeah, I've also heard other stories, and I think Colin Ross has been part of some of those investigations as well when it comes to actually developing pretty much a spy that actually is compartmentalized, and that they've developed this technique to actually break up the personality in the capacity that they can actually use, you know, the person. In some cases, there might have even been famous, you know, people or stuff like that they can carry information or knowledge, and they can literally don't know what they're carrying because you have this split within the personality, and then you can simply trigger, you know, this other person to come out, and you can they've been used as agents basically for the CIA and intelligence services. What do you know about that?
Well, that's absolutely correct. And the CIA makes no pretense of this. If you look into the history of mind control or CIA involvement, the specific reason for it was to develop super spies for the USA, and that's, you know, what they do. The problem is they don't say that they're doing it on children. And that's what's been so frustrating to me, is you have, you know, these congressional hearings where they bring these survivors in and they testify that they were abused as children, and then Congress doesn't release the information, and you never hear that, you know, they're actually doing this to children. I know one survivor who was a witness at one of the congressional hearings, and she is actually not allowed to talk about specifics of what she went through as a child, because it's in the interest of national security agreement that she had to sign, that she can't reveal, you know, that this happened to her as a child. And it's absolutely disgusting to me that this is still going on, and we aren't even able to find out the truth about it.
How many, I mean, there's a number of these mind control programs going on. We know about Project MKUltra, of course, and there's many subdivisions to this. It's been, you know, going on for a long time, and it's CIA's involvement. They have used LSD and you know, and a number of these things, and it's been coming out throughout the years. Yet it seems to be very much kind of confined to the, I'd say from the early 40s or 50s, really, and then up to the 70s or 80s, and then it seems to be kind of like, it fell out, it was defunct, you know, even Project MK Naomi, MK Delta, there's a number of these subsets to it. But in your view, is this something that has been continuously ongoing and a technique that has been further refined and maybe put into other programs that we don't even know about today?
I believe it has been, and it, the only way we're ever going to prove this is through the testimonies of the survivors. For instance, in the 1995 congressional hearings, you have women in there talking about how they had been abused as children at the same time that the CIA was claiming that they closed down the program in 1964, yet these women at the 1995 congressional hearings were abused as late as 1984, 20 years after they said that they were closed down. And they're in those hearings pleading with the Congress to open up an investigation. After 1995, no investigation was done. The Congress actually voted not to release the results of their of the hearings. And we just recently have these YouTube videos out on these survivors talking in these hearings. It's obviously going on. You can see that from the 2007 ritual abuse surveys, that thousands of people have been involved, not only here in the United States. They had an agreement with Canada, and there's a lot of I could go into Canada quite a bit with the coalition we have with Kevin Annette, but it was in Canada. And then we have this petition that we have formed that you can find on Child Abuse Recovery. And in this petition, we're asking Congress for another investigation. Well, we started this petition, and right now you can go in and read the comments on this petition. There's over 40 from mind control survivors, and these are people that are saying, this has happened to me, this is happening right now, this has happened to my child. And it's obvious that it's going on, because survivors are saying, yeah, it happened to me and it's going on right now. And I've got children that were born into this and taken away from me, and they're being used in the program. So obviously it's going on, it's just being covered up.
The petition you said is ongoing, and it's on the website. Give us that website again and where to go to participate in that if people want to.
Okay, the website is childabuserecovery.com. And on that website, there's a petition survivors request a congressional investigation of the CIA mind control program. Just click on that petition. It'll bring it up. Then you just click on, you know, that you agree with the petition. And you could go in there and read all these comments from all these survivors. They're very, very interesting to look at. And they're going on all over the world. I mean, there's one in there. There's one comment from someone in France that said, I was CIA mind controlled in France. And there was another one that said from Asia that they were mind controlled by the CIA. So they didn't keep it just to U.S. children. We're talking about a global problem.
Oh yeah, we know about some of the chemical experimentation that was done on in one of the French villages. I forget the name now. I can have that linked up as well. But it was a basically dumping LSD upon this small village, and it's been an ongoing kind of controversy around that. So why it would end specifically just to those kinds of things is it doesn't really make sense. There's a lot of other applications, of course, of what could be done. With people with the stay behind armies in Europe after the Second World War, etc. It's I bet it's definitely is ongoing. But for those who want to check that out, then childabuserecovery.com. That's the website for that. And then, you know, Judy, before we take a break here and talk more about this in the second hour, give us the other website as well then, and let people know how they can pick up a copy of the book if they want to read more about this case.
Okay, it's 22faces. The number's 22faces. FACES.com. And on that website, there's a number of ways you can buy the book. Also on that website is you can read the first chapter for free. Just click in there. And the first chapter is very interesting because it shows how Jenny functioned as a 5- and 6-year-old child with multiple personalities. And I've been told by ritual abuse survivors that they so appreciate that because people just don't understand what it's like to be a child and have these blank periods in your life and know that you're being abused, but you can't talk about it because they're threatening you with death if you do. But also you can't remember what's going on. So that reading that first chapter would give your listeners a good idea of what it's like to be dissociative.
All right, very good. 22faces.com and the other website that we mentioned, we're going to have that up on redicecreations.com. as well. And we'll continue, of course, to ask more questions here in the second. I want to ask more about what Jenny, how she's doing today, basically, and what she's up to here. But stay with us, Judy. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back with more in a little bit.
Thank you. says in my dreams, like waves, like the sea, on the tracks of a train, set myself
Before we proceed, Joseph Farrell and Scott DeHart is next up on Red Ice Radio. Join us again in just a few days. But right now, stay with us as we proceed with more in the second hour to hear about Jenny Hill, her story, and Judy's research into satanic ritual abuse. We are going to ask more about where Jenny is today and just for how long she was subjected to this. We discuss the conditions of her ritual and what some of the reasons might be that the participators are involved in this to begin with. We talk about drugs, adrenochrome, and if there is a supernatural component to this, whether it's a demonic interaction. All right, the second hour is available at our members' website. You can sign up if you're not yet a subscriber to continue to listen to this or any of our previous programs. We have a ton of shows lined up for you on all kinds of different topics that we are certain will make you think, question, and want to learn more about. RedIceMembers.com is a website. Subscribe and we'll continue our discussion right there.